befuddled. She's being kind to Ruth again? Becky stood slowly, wincing from the aches in her bones. Surely so. Ruth lit up like a lantern when she saw them fancy clothes again. Promised to be quiet as ever. Made short work of the gingerbread Madam baked, too. This was too much. I sat down at the table. Madam baked? She's a fair hand in the kitchen when she puts her mind to it. Left the dishes for yours truly, but the cake was tasty. Those two pieces are for you. She was most firm about it. She stopped to cough up what sounded like a large wet worm from her throat. She cooked up sweet milk for you, too, with nutmeg, cinnamon, and sugar. Said you was to have some with your gingerbread. I sniffed the pitcher. It smelled good enough. Did you have any? Not with this cough. Milk would stop up my lungs. I looked around the kitchen. Where's Ruth now? Becky unpinned her apron and folded it, then tied on her bonnet, preparing to go home. Madam got it in her head to play cards this eve. Has two companions in with her, the Mrs. Drinkwater and her daughter, the one who's to marry some sort of lord or duke or some such. Ruth is in with them. She was right cheered after the cake and milk. Should I take anything in? I just come from there. Madam was most definite. Tell Sal to enjoy her cake and a night off. She has worked hard these weeks and could do with a good night's sleep. She called me Sal instead of girl, I asked. And you are full certain she didn't hit her head today. Becky laughed, and the laugh caught in her throat and bubbled into a cough. Look here. She's likely to turn back into a sour old cow by breakfast, so I say have a good sit-down and enjoy a little peace. I poured a mug of the milk. Huzzah for the Reverend's wife. I wanted to savor the gingerbread bite by bite and sip the milk slowly, but I couldn't help myself. The mug was drained and the plate empty soon after Becky left. The milk was the sweetest thing I had ever tasted. The spices so thick I could near chew them. No wonder Ruth was cheered by it. I washed up my dishes, tidied the kitchen, and found myself with idle hands, a rare event indeed. I might could sneak into the library and borrow that Crusoe book. I could read by the fire with a mending basket nearby to slip the book into should Madam approach. That seemed a fine plan. But first, I wanted to shed my bodice. It pinched something awful under my arms. I felt my way down the cellar stairs with my toes and heard the sound of laughter from Madam's company. I yawned. When would they leave? And what sort of ladies came to call this late? I removed my bodice and hung it on a nail. The pallet looked soothing and cool, and the thought of climbing the stairs again made me weary. But I would like to read a few more pages. But I was overly fatigued. But Mr. Crusoe was facing all sorts of dangers, but in betwixt one thought and the next, I fell asleep. For that, I shall never forgive myself. Chapter 21, Wednesday, July 10th, 1776. To be sold at the office of William Tongue, broker, at the house of the late Mr. Waldron near the Exchange, lower end of Broad Street. The following goods and merchandise, viz. One Negro wench, 22 years old, has had smallpox, is a useful domestic. One Negro boy, 16 years old. One Negro wench, 30 years old, with or without her son, 5 years old. Advertisement in the New York Gazette and Weekly Mercury newspaper. In my dream, I stood on a sandy beach, my back to the sea, the moon over my left shoulder. An enormous map was unrolled at my feet. The roads on it were marked with velvet black ink, rivers of pearly blue, mountains of speckled green. It was a map of a country I had never before seen. Just as I opened my mouth to call for Ruth, who always tagged along in my dreams, a thick mist blew over the beach. The roads on the map twined and twisted round each other, hesitating. Then they rose up off the paper. No longer roads, but thick eels with amber eyes. They crawled out of the map, and I feared they would bite me. They pondered me a moment, then slithered down the beach and into the water. I awoke with a start and flung aside the blanket, looking for the eels. There were none there, nor in the potato bin. Ruth wasn't there neither, and her side of the pallet was cold. She was gone to the privy, no doubt. I needed to visit the same place. The sun was already in the trees when I stepped outside. How had I slept so late? Ruth, I called, walking toward the little building, my nose wrinkled. The Lockton's would soon need to dig a new privy hole. Ruth! I knocked on the door and it swung open. The seat was empty with a few flies buzzing in the stench. Two blue jays in the sycamore tree called loudly. There was the distant sound of officers shouting orders on Broadway and the clatter of cartwheels. But no Ruth. I made quick work of looking in the yard. The back entry to the stables was locked. She could not have gone out that way. The gate to the street was closed, too, and the latch too high for Ruth to reach. Had Madame already dressed her, taken her on a call? A thought slid through me, quick and slimy as a cold eel. I ran for the kitchen door. Becky! Becky! She came out of the pantry as I flew through the door. Where's Ruth? Oh. Becky looked down at the worn tips of her shoes, then turned away from me. Her eyes were puddled up and red-rimmed. I can't find her, I said. She was gone when I woke. Have you seen her? Becky took the jar of flour down from the shelf. You know where she is, don't you? She removed the lid and stuck the scoop into the flour. Tell me. Becky shook her head from side to side. I should have started this bread earlier, she said, pouring the flour into the bowl. The wet air will ruin the loaves. That's my concern. I should have stayed and baked in the cool of the night. She dabbed her eyes in her sleeve and measured out another scoop of flour. But Madame sent me home, said she wanted a quiet house last night, no bacon. She looked at me over her shoulder. The eel squeezed out all my air. No, I said. I wouldn't have gone if I'd known. No, no, no. I backed away, shaking my head. She didn't, she wouldn't. No. Isabel, don't. Becky followed me down the hall, trying to control her voice. It won't change anything. What's done is done. Ruth! I screamed up the staircase. Stop, Isabel. Becky grabbed my arm and pulled me backward, clamping a flour-covered hand over my mouth. You can't storm around here like a banshee. Madam will beat you bloody. Me too. I pushed her hand away and wiped off the flour. Where is she? What did they do to her? She's gone, Becky said. Gone? I repeated. Gone where? Becky studied her shoes again. Sold. I stopped hearing right. No more birds or buzzing flies or grandfather clock marking time. Sold. I repeated. No, she's not. They didn't. Becky's eyes filled again. Yes, she said quietly. She did. I paced the hall. No, I slept too heavy last night. Didn't notice when she woke. She wandered outside. We need to find her. She could be lost, could have taken ill and fallen. Becky watched me go to and fro. The sweet milk Madame made up, I figured it contained a sleep potion. Knocked you out so cold they could spirit her away. I am dreadful, powerful sorry, but they sold her away from you. It made no sense. I would have known. I would have woken up, fought them off, killed whoever tried to take her from me. I took care of Ruth. I promised Mama I always would. Becky's face shrank down to the size of a coin. It sounded like she spoke through a long wooden pipe. Madam was returning in the carriage when I arrived this morn, she said. Told me not to worry about the milk spoiling no more, that Ruth was headed to Nevis, sold to a physician's family. I shook my head, trying to clear my brain pan. Where's Nevis? How do I get there? Becky's face grew larger. You need to sit down. I'll get a cloth for your head. This has been a right shock to you. Where's Nevis? My voice echoed off the walls. West Indies, Becky muttered. The islands? All of Mama's terrible stories of slave life in the islands flooded back. Ruth can't cut cane. She'll die. She'll die in a day. My feet started for the front door. Wait. Becky grabbed my arm to prevent me from running off. I questioned Madame about that very fact, questioned her right close, I did. Not to cut cane, said she, but to be a housemaid in a fine house, a physician's house, so they'll care for her should she fall. She's lying, I said. She's a spiteful, hateful liar. A door opened on the second floor. Becky, Madame asked, has someone come to call? No, ma'am. Becky said in a false high voice. Madam came down the stairs, one hand on the railing, the other holding a sheet of paper, half covered with writing. The paintings of her dead ancestors on the wall watched her.
I do not appreciate interruptions when I am communicating with my husband, she said. What is the matter here?
Nothing, ma'am, Becky stuttered. I was giving the girl her directions for the morning.
Madam looked down without seeing me. She looked at my face, my kerchief, my shift neatly tucked into my skirt, looked at my shoes pinching my feet, looked at my hands that were stronger than hers. She did not look into my eyes, did not see the lion inside. She did not see the me of me, the Isabel. I saw her. I saw all the way down to her withered soul. I walked up two steps.
Did you sell Ruth?
You will not address me in that insolent manner.
Her voice shook a little.
Becky wrung her hands. Come, Isabel, you need to peel the potatoes. Would Madam like some tea or coffee?
I took another step up.
Answer me, you miserable cow. Did you sell my sister?
Madam backed up a step. Her letter fluttered to the bottom of the stairs. Her ancestors hung silent.
Stay away from me, she said. Get back to the kitchen.
She is 5 years old. I rose another step.
She is a baby, and you sold her away from me?
She swallowed hard. Her hands quivered. I wanted to grab her by the hair and throw her down the stairs, throw her out a window, beat her face with my fist. I wanted her blood to splash the painting, soak the wall and the wooden stairs.
Isabel, Becky warned.
The sunlight coming through the window was rosy red. I took the next step. I was almost close enough to reach her.
Isabel, Becky tried again.
One more step and I can have you hung, Madam whispered. I held my breath. There was a click of metal on metal. Becky had opened the front door wide. A hot wind from the street rose up the stairs, fluttering our skirts and causing me to turn. Madam grabbed a painting from the wall and threw it down on my head. I raised my arm too late and the frame crashed into me. The blow made me addlepated and weakened my knees. Madam ran upstairs, screaming like a house of fire. Becky dragged me down the steps and shoved me toward the open door.
Run, she screamed.
I ran out the front door for the first time. People walking under the shade of the sycamores across the street paused at the sight of a slave running away from a mansion where a woman was screaming. A man called after me.
You there, girl!
I ran straight down wall. Didn't worry about escaping notice of soldiers or strangers, just flew over the cobblestones as fast as I could. The red fog slowly rolled out of my mind. There were more shouts behind me, and people turning to stare at the cause of the commotion. I didn't dare take the time to turn around. Past City Hall, cross Broadway. I leapt over the remains of a sentry fire, bumped into a gray-bearded soldier wearing a homespun shirt, and startled a man carrying two live hens by the feet. One of the hens broke free in an explosion of feathers. The man shook his fist and called out for someone to stop me. I ducked down one street after another, trying to find a way to the river, but the army had erected barricades at the end of most of the roads to keep out the British. I was pinned in. The shouts behind me grew louder and closer. I darted down an alley, turned blindly toward the right, and ran smack into the barrel chest of a giant.
Whoa there, young filly, a deep voice boomed. Don't want to go swimming in the river, do you?
I had run straight into a blacksmith. Please, sir, I said. His enormous hands released me, and I looked over my shoulder.
Looking to get away from someone, I suspect, the blacksmith said.
Behind him billowed the cold smoke from the forge. The air was filled with a high tang of metal and sweat.
You hurt, child, the blacksmith said. In need of some help?
I wanted to spill out my story and to trust he could advise me. But he was a stranger. They were all strangers, and Ruth was gone, and there was blood on my forehead from the painting Madam threw at me, and she was going to see me hung, and I'd never be able to rescue Ruth, and she would be all alone, and... Tell them I went north. I gasped as I picked up my skirts and darted around the forge to the south. The blacksmith called after me, but his words were lost in the din of the soldiers and the sailors who cluttered my path. The wind off the river cooled my face and helped with my decision. I would turn myself over to the rebels. I had helped them fair and square. Now it was their turn. We were all fighting for liberty. Ad Astra, I shouted. The words were not as magic as I had hoped, but the door eventually opened. Colonel Reagan was sitting in a chair, a white cloth around his neck, his face covered with foamy soap and his eyes closed. Behind him stood a barber, a slave, I assumed, because of his African skin, with grizzled hair and an apron. On the table beside him stood a bowl of steaming water, a leather strap for blades, and a cup of lather with a brush in it. He turned the colonel's chin with one finger, then delicately shaved away a stripe of soap with a razor.
"By your leave, sir," said the sentry.
"I am busy," the colonel said without opening his eyes.
"This girl knew the password, insisted on seeing you," the sentry continued.
The barber scraped off another stripe of soap and whiskers.
"Take her to Jameson," the colonel said.
"No," I said. The barber froze in mid-shave and the colonel opened his eyes.
"Please, sir, you must help me," I said quickly, "as I once helped you. She sold my sister. Please, sir, I'll do anything. Just find Ruth. She's so small and..."
The door behind us opened. Two more sentries filed in, followed by Madame Lockton, breathing hard, and a tall gentleman I had not seen before. My sentry waved me farther into the room so that the newcomers might all fit. I worked my way toward an open window.
"What is the meaning of this?"
the colonel asked wearily. Madame's voice cracked across the room.
"Are you the man in charge?"
The colonel sighed deeply, waved off the barber, and stood up, his face still half covered with soap.
"Colonel Thomas Reagan at your service, ma'am."
He bowed stiffly from the waist.
"How can I be of service?"
"You have stolen my property," Madame announced.
"We have several clerks assigned to record civilian concerns. My sergeant will show you..."
"I will not speak with subordinates or grubby clerks. That chit of a girl belongs to me, Colonel. She has committed terrible crimes and must be punished. I demand you return her to me."
The barber rinsed the razor in the water bowl. Reagan looked from Madame to me and back again.
"What did she do?"
"She abused me most violently, sir."
The colonel put out his hand and the barber placed a clean towel in it.
"Yet it is the girl with blood on her face," the colonel said, wiping away the soap from his chin and cheeks.
Madame's eyes narrowed.
"Give her to me."
The sentries shifted their boots on the floor. One cleared his throat. The gentleman who accompanied Madame stepped forward.
"The law is quite clear in this matter, sir. None of us want to live in a world where servants rule their masters. Both the Parliament and the Congress give Madame Lockton rule over her slave."
A flock of crows swooped past the window. A three-masted ship, sails unfurled, pushed down the river. Ruth could be on it. Or was she already at sea, in a dark hold with no candles? Who would feed her? Who would hold her when she shook?
"The girl says you've sold her sister," Colonel Reagan said.
"Do you mean to purchase Sal for the army?" Madame asked. "I'm sure she'd make a passing fine washwoman. I shall expect full payment in cash."
He handed the towel back to the barber.
"A washwoman is the one thing I don't need right now. If you had any manservants capable of ditch digging, I'd take you up on the offer, but..."
He paused and shook his head. I looked out the window again. One crow had come back. It landed on a carcass near the water's edge, a dead dog or a rat. The crow pecked at the meat of the thing, snatched a pink strip in his beak, and tugged until the piece broke away. He beat his wings once, twice, and flew up in the air, high enough to catch a breeze that rolled him out over the water. Another man had entered the room. The night of my first visit to the fort, he had worn his uniform coat over his nightshirt. Now his coat was properly buttoned and his breeches tucked into his boots.
"Thomas, we cannot interfere," he said. "This girl is not our concern, and you are late. We dare not keep him waiting."
I looked out the window at the carcass.
"Please, sir," I said in a quiet voice, "let me stay."
Colonel Reagan fastened his collar without looking at me.
"The law binds my hands and my actions. You must return with your mistress," he said, concentrating on his task. Even during time of war, we must follow the rules of propriety and civilization.
With that, the matter was concluded. Madam turned to thank the man who aided her. The sentry slipped into the hall. Colonel Reagan picked up his hat from the table and set it on his head. As I stepped toward the window, the barber studied me close. He shook his head from side to side, just as Jenny had back in Rhode Island 100 years ago. Bad advice on both occasions. I bolted for the open window. I almost made it. Chapter 22. Wednesday, July 10th through Monday, July 15th, 1776. But as it is, we have the wolf by the ear, and we can neither hold him nor safely let him go. Justice is in one scale and self-preservation in the other. Thomas Jefferson, writing about slavery. When I woke, the barrel of a gun was stuck up underneath my chin. Men voices shouted. Boots stomped. A rain of hands grabbed at me, countless bodies, smelly breath, unwashed feet. My head felt cracked in 3 pieces. A woman shrieked and shrieked. She was a crow shattering the air with her harsh calls. I moved, not by my own devices. My toes dragged in the dirt. They tried to pull my arms from my body, ripping the arms off a cloth dowel. They dragged me from one place to a second place. More shouts, more shrieks, and whistles and calls, rumbling thunder voices. They dragged me from the second place to the third place, every voice sowing the wind, all things summoning the whirlwind that would sweep us all away to drown in the deepest sea. My thoughts would not line up like good soldiers. They swarmed a field and fled, chasing the blood that dripped from my head and stained my shift. My eyes were swolled up and hard to see through. Someone had stolen a tooth or two. They tied my hands together with prickly rope. They tied the rope to the back of a cart. They tied a horse to the front of the cart. The horse lifted one tired hoof after another and dragged the cart, and the cart dragged me up the broad street where people smiled and laughed and pointed. My eyes cast down. The cobblestones mocked too. I tried to figure the whos and the whys of the matter, but my own name escaped me, and I knew only the pain in my head and the iron taste of lost teeth. My memory broke into bits when they beat my head. They took me to the dungeon under City Hall to await my trial. The jailer locked me in a cell with a toothless madwoman who huddled in the corner and spat at me. She pulled the hairs from her head and dropped them to the mud. She was near bald. At sunset, the jailer came back with a cup of water and a piece of foul pork half the size of my hand. Dirty men in the other cells fought each other all night long. On the second day, we heard shouts and screams from the world above us. Then came the boom and roar of cannons, followed by the crack of musket fire and the sounds of hundreds of booths shaking the earth. Some prisoners hollered in panic and tried to pull their chains from the stone walls. The madwoman in my cell laughed and laughed, slapping her skirts. At last the noise above ceased. The jailers threw buckets of cold water on the men who had lost their senses in fear. They said for us to shut our gobs. The British had sailed their warships up the North River and had fired on the town, but now all danger was past. Anyone who continued to blubber would feel the lash. I said not a word. The second night was same as the first, filled with moans and muttering, scratching, and the sound of teeth and claw. It rained. Water pooled on the floor and soaked through my shoes. Rats wandered in and out of the cells, squeezing their fat bottoms through the bars. I dared not sleep for fear they would bite me. The madwoman and the rat stayed in the corner, red eyes waiting for me all night long. On the third morning, the jailer unlocked my cell and motioned for me to follow him. The madwoman laughed again. He took me up the stairs to the courtroom. It was as big as the inside of a church, with the same white walls and dark wood. The windows were of clear glass, grimy with neglect. They stood me behind a rail, kept my hands tied. I shook with fever and hunger. "Oye, oye, oye," called a man in the shadows. He said more, but his words slurred together. A tall man wearing black robes and a long wig sat at a table that was raised on a platform. He was a judge. This was a court. My head was broken, my sister was stolen, I was lost. The woman with the crow voice,
her that threw the picture at me, stood up. I raised my head to look at her. Someone poked a stick into my ribs hard and hissed at me. I lowered my eyes. Voices buzzed and blurred into words I did not understand. Lockton, I finally remembered. Lockton, Madam Lockton, her that bought us, her that stole Ruth away. I kept my head down but lifted my eyes, though they pained me. The pain was good. It drew back the curtains of my mind and forced me to pay attention. Madam was pretending to cry into her lace handkerchief.
And I am but a poor woman, alone, my husband having fled for reasons I cannot comprehend. I plead with your honor to assist me in the correct punishment of this girl.
The judge frowned and asked questions of two officers who stood near Madam. I wanted to ask about Ruth and where the blood on my shift came from and who broke my teeth. But I was the only person in the room whose hands were tied, so I kept silent. Questions were asked of the incident. Lies were given as answers. Finally, the judge said,
Where is the housekeeper who saw this crime, Mrs. Lockton?
Becky is indisposed, sir,
Madam answered.
She suffers the ague.
Are there no other witnesses to the events you describe?
A stranger stood up in the back of the room.
I was passing in the street, Your Honor, he said. I heard the commotion, saw the girl fleeing, and observed the destruction myself.
There are several other people of standing willing to testify, Your Honor, Madam added.
Her tears had mysteriously vanished. The judge used the end of his quill to scratch at an itch under his wig.
It is clear that this slave has violated the person of her master, destroyed valuable property, and attempted to run away, all contrary to the laws of our colony.
State, Your Honor, reminded the lawyer. We are a state now, independence and all that.
The judge rolled his eyes.
Colony, state, who knows what we will be next?
He sighed deeply.
No matter. This girl's crimes of insolence, property destruction, and running away from her rightful owner are not devious enough to warrant a sentence of death. Do you have any wishes as to the punishment that I should consider, Mrs. Lockton?
Madam sighed deeply, like my behavior caused her great sadness.
She is a willful girl, Your Honor, with numerous character defects. I believe a permanent reminder of this day might prove the appropriate remedy.
Her words stuck in the air, like flies caught in a spider's web. I could make no sense of them. I could make no sense of anything.
The judge scratched at his wig with fresh vigor. You wanted her branded, then. 20 strokes of the lash would be more in keeping with her crimes. We are now led by men from Virginia, I am told, she said. Land of my birth. I assure Your Honor that in Virginia, we do not tolerate the rebellion of slaves.
The judge nodded.
Once kindled, rebellion can spread like wildfire. Do you want your husband's initials used?
Madam shot a sideways glance at me.
I prefer the girl branded with the letter I for insolence. It will alert people to her tendencies and serve as a reminder of her weakness.
The judge picked up his gavel.
So be it. Sal Lockton, it is the order of this court that you be branded on your right cheek with the letter of I in punishment for your crimes against your lady mistress. Crack!
The gavel cracked on the block of wood.
Next case.
Chapter 23. Monday, July 15th, 1776. I also have been whipped many a time on my naked skin, and sometimes till the blood has run down over my waistband. But the greatest grief I then had was to see them whip my mother, and to hear her, on her knees, begging for mercy. Reverend David George, on his childhood as a slave. A man pulled me by my rope outside to the courtyard. After 2 days in the dungeon, the noonday sun scalded my eyes. I stumbled but did not fall. The man led me to the stocks, then untied my hands and pointed. I laid my head and hands in the crescents carved into the wood. He lowered the top board, pinning me in place, and secured the two pieces together with a large padlock. A brazier filled with hot coals set on the ground a few lengths in front of me. A second man stuck two branding irons into the metal basket to heat them up. My knees turned to water. I sagged against the wood.
Stand up, girl, or you'll choke yourself,
growled the man locked into the stocks to my left.
I couldn't turn my head enough to see him, but his voice was rough and scarred.
"Whatever you do, don't scream," he continued. "That's what they want to hear."
I did not answer him, but forced my knees to hold me up. The wood locked around my neck was rough and splintering. My hands were soon without sensation, my neck and arms pricked 100-fold by pitchforks. Two men were housed in the iron cage next to City Hall. One lay on the ground, asleep or dead. The second, his skin burned by the sun and peeling and missing his left ear, stared back at me blankly. A court official, his coat covered with yellow dust, arrived with a man who wore a leather apron. He set to work pumping a hand bellows to increase the heat under the branding irons. The bellows wheezed in and out while the sun rose higher in the sky. It had rained in the night. The mud puddles scattered around the yard gave off steam like cauldrons coming to boil. Sweat rolled off my face and fell in great drops to the dirt below. The wind shifted and blew the smoke from the brazier into our faces. I held my breath. In betwixt me and the brazier, dandelions grew in the mud. The man in the dusty coat pulled one of the branding irons out of the fire. He brought it close to his face and spit on it. The iron sizzled. My companion coughed and cursed the court officials and the judge who had sentenced him. A crowd had gathered a few lengths on the other side of the brazier, mostly soldiers and tradesmen, with a few women, one carrying a babe in her arms. I thought I saw a boy in a red hat, but when I blinked, he was gone. Men at the front of the crowd called us names and jeered. The sunburned man in the cage yelled back, and soon the courtyard was filled with shouts and filthy language, the kinds of words my mother never wanted me to say or hear. I fought against tears and lost. They fell to the dust in big drops, too. If I cried a river, maybe I could swim away or slip under the water to freedom. The man in the dusty coat said something to the man in the leather apron. I could not hear him because of the noise of the crowd and the crackling coals and the beat of my heart in my ears. The men walked toward me. The dandelions were lemon yellow with bright green leaves and thick stalks pointing at the sky. At home in Rhode Island, the corn was tall as Ruth now. The spring lambs would be too heavy to pick up. The new goat, he'd be running headfirst into every fence post. This was a good day to bleach the wool. The man with the leather apron pinned my head against the wood. He stank of charcoal. I tried to pull away, but my hands and head were locked fast. The splinters chewed on me. Dandelions grew in the mud. The glowing iron streaked in front of my face like a comet. The crowd roared. The man pushed the hot metal against my cheek. It hissed and bubbled. Smoke curled under my nose. They cooked me. The man stepped back and pulled the iron away. The fire in my face burned on and on, deep through my flesh, searing my soul. Stars exploded off the top of my head, and all of my words and all of my rememberies followed them up to the sun, burning to ash that floated back and settled in the mud. A few people at the edge of the crowd had fallen silent. They walked away with their heads down. My mama and papa appeared from the shadows. They flew to me and wrapped their arms around me and cooled my face with their ghost tears. Night crept into my soul. Chapter 24. Monday, July 15th through Sunday, July 21st, 1776. The time is now near at hand, which must probably determine whether Americans are to be freemen or slaves. The fate of unborn millions will now depend, under God, on the courage and conduct of this army. We have therefore to resolve to conquer or die. Message issued to Continental troops from New York Military Headquarters, July 1776. The spark kindled on my cheek flared and spread through my entire body. First my eyes, then hair, then down my limbs, until even my toes and fingers felt they were aflame. Strange scenes swam before me, first in light, then darkness, then light again. I saw Papa. But no, not truly him. Another son of Africa, brow furrowed, his voice deep and strong as a church bell. Mama hovered over me, but her face faded into a woman I did not know, older than Mama, with strands of white in her hair. She talked Jamaica, more song than words, and brought bitter tea to my mouth and made the world smell of lemons and told me to sleep. I asked about Ruth over and over again,
and tried to apologize for letting her get stole, but the words were sawdust in my mouth. Corzine's face floated up in front of me. He told me to shake my lazy bones and get out of bed. He did not turn into a dead person from when I was little. This was a strange comfort. I blinked, and he was gone. The room was dark again, with starlight in the windows and the sounds of a baby crying, and farther away, the barking of a lonely dog. Strangest of all was the hive of bees that had taken up residence inside of me. They swarmed under my skin and gave off peculiar vibrations. The buzzing echoed in my brain pan and crowded out my thoughts. The fire in me burned on and on. I woke. I did not know where I was. This was not Rhode Island, or the hold of a ship, or the locked-in cellar, or any other room in their house. It certainly was not the dungeon under City Hall. Was this a dream? Had I passed over to the land of the dead? Did ghosts sleep on clean sheets that smelled of mint? I sat up. The room was warm and quite small, but entirely free of dirt, vermin, and mice. The walls were freshly whitewashed and the floor polished. Lace curtains fluttered in the window. Through it I saw the tops of trees. This was an attic room, then. The bed was softer than anything I had ever lain in, properly made up with linens, two pillows, and a coverlet of deep blue. A chair was positioned next to the bed, and a chamber pot, empty, rested under that. I tried to stand, but the room spun around me, and I plopped back down. I was wearing my shift, still stained with blood at the neckline, but my skirt, stockings, and bodice were not to be seen, or my shoes. I closed my eyes tight, then opened them again. Same room, still no shoes. The door opened, and in stepped the funny-talking Dutch maid of Lady Seymour. Her eyes flew open wide. Then she slammed the door shut and ran away. A moment later, the door opened again, and in walked the lady herself. "Ah," she said with faint surprise, "you've come back to us." She poured water from the jug into a mug, handed it to me, and sat on the chair. I drank down a gulp. My lips were dried and cracked. When I swallowed, it caused my burned cheek to ache. My fingers flew up to check the wound. There was a cloth stuck to my face, with ointment oozing out from the edges. Lady Seymour leaned forward and gently removed my hand. "Best not to touch it yet," she said. The healer woman put a comfrey salve on it to draw out the pestilence. "Beg pardon, ma'am," I croaked. My voice was raspy with lack of use. "But where am I, and why?"
She glanced out the window before she spoke, her mouth set in a grim line. "How best to say this?" she began. I waited, not sure how to answer. "You have lain here, near insensible, for 6 days."
"Six? Do you remember what happened?"
"The bees threatened to overtake my mind again, their wings beating quickly. I took another drink of water."
"I remember some. The rest is a jumble, ma'am."
"You tried to run away and were beaten in the attempt. You passed 2 days under City Hall and emerged gravely ill with fever and heaven knows what else. After your trial, you were branded. I was not aware of these events until after they occurred. Your friend with the red hat came to the door with the news that you were near dead in the stocks. After consulting with Anne, I arranged to have you transported here." She looked directly at me. "I further questioned Anne and discovered her version of the events. I find the buying and selling of children most repugnant. Your reaction to the news of your sister, while unfortunate, was understandable, in my view."
"Ruth! Ruth! Ruth!" buzzed the bees. I blinked back tears. "Do you know who bought my sister, ma'am?"
"I have so far failed to uncover that fact." She stood up and walked to the window. "My nephew's wife is stubborn as well as intemperate." I clutched at the bed covers. "I will find her." She pulled the lace curtain aside and studied something passing in the street below. I thought through what she said and found a slim thread of hope to grasp hold of. "Begging pardon again, ma'am, but do I work for you now?" She let the curtain fall. I am afraid not. Anne insists that you be returned to her household as soon as you are able. The law supports her position, I fear, and in these unsettled times there is little remedy. A wave of weariness crashed over me at the thought of serving Madame again, of allowing her to see her mark upon my face every day. I expect you'd like to bathe, Lady Seymour said. Angelica is preparing the water for you as we speak. You'll find the rest of your clothes in the kitchen. She paused in the doorway. You miss your parents terribly, don't you? Pardon, ma'am? While you lay in the fever, you spoke of them with great affection, as if they were in the room with us. She hesitated for a moment, then picked up her skirts. No matter. I will escort you back to Anne's once you've bathed and eaten. Angelica took the trouble to make the tub full and the water warm and sweet-smelling. I thanked her and she gave me a little smile. She said something in the Dutch speech, which I did not understand. We must have looked two fools, me speaking English, her talking Dutch, both nodding our heads and wishing we had the right words. My clothes had been washed and ironed, my shoes wiped clean of mud and muck. Even better was the meal of fried eggs, toasted bread, and a fruit compote of pears and apples topped with strawberries and cream. When Angelica set the food in front of me, her eyes went to the fresh scar on my face. Rinsed clean of salve and patted dry, she winced at the sight. As I wiped up the last of my egg with the bread, Lady Seymour entered, followed by her cat. She had changed into a peach-colored crinoline gown and was pulling on lace gloves. It is time, she said. I walked two steps behind her, carrying a basket of daisies and a heart filled with dread. When we arrived at the Lockton's, she walked up the front steps without ever looking back at me. She paused before she lifted the door knocker. Go on, she said. I opened the side gate to the garden, entered, and closed it behind me. I heard the knocker booming under Lady Seymour's hand as I walked slowly to the back door. Part 2 Chapter 25 Sunday, July 21st, through Tuesday, August 20th, 1776. Our slaves, sir, cost us money, and we buy them to make money by their labor. If they are sick, they are not only unprofitable, but expensive. Benjamin Franklin, The Gazetteer and New Daily Advertiser. Melancholy held me hostage, and the bees built a hive of sadness in my soul. Dark honey filled up inside me, drowning my thoughts and making it hard to move my eyes and hands. I worked as a puppet trained to scrub and carry, curtsy and nod. Madam would not look at me. When she had an order to give, it went through Becky, even if we all stood in the same room. Tell the girl the hearth needs sweeping. Sal, Becky would say, please sweep the hearth. Tell the girl to fetch my fan. Sal, Becky would say, please fetch Madam's ivory fan. The library needs dusting. Tell the girl. Sal, I swept the hearth and fetched the fan. I dusted the library without looking at the books on the shelves or the horse on the wall. I preferred the chores that took me out of the kitchen, for it was there the bees tricked me into seeing Ruth's ghost playing on the floor, churning butter, or counting out kernels of corn. When her voice whispered to me, I caught fire again from my toes to my face, and I burned slow like damp wood. Becky watched me careful when I turned inside myself like that. She once tried to apologize for what happened. The instant she stopped talking, I forgot what she said. Tell the girl there are bedbugs in my chamber. Tell the girl to wash the steps. Corzin came round day after day and talked to me through the boards of the fence. I did not answer him. July marched out, and August sailed in on a suffocating tide. British ships continued to land at Staten Island, hundreds of them carrying thousands of soldiers armed with countless guns and bullets. We went 2 weeks without rain. There were outbreaks of camp fever, smallpox, and dysentery amongst the rebel troops. They turned King's College into a hospital to care for thousands of sick men. I prayed that Colonel Reagan was there. I prayed he would fall ill and die a terrible death for lying to me and betraying me and letting them break my body. Whenever I heard the words liberty or freedom, I wanted to spit in the dust. The air was steeped in evil during those muggy, pestilent days.
Tell the girl to sweep the cellar.
When I swept it, I found the cobwebs I had saved for Ruth. I threw them into the kitchen fire, along with the mouse carcasses and rotted potatoes.
Tell the girl the milk has soured.
'Twas left in the sun on purpose. The British finally made a move toward the end of August, rowing half their army across to the Long Island in flat-bottom boats. Becky convinced Madam to send me to market on my own again because she was afraid to go, what with battle due to break out any minute. Madam agreed. She said my mark would ensure I stayed out of trouble. As commanded, I purchased 2 packets of straight pins, a piece of lace, and a basket of turnip greens. The shopkeepers and other folks looked at my face and saw only the angry red scar, just starting to fade at the edges. They did not see the girl hidden behind it. Corzine approached me on Pearl Street and tried to talk. I walked away from him and carried the purchases back to Madam's house, wings abuzz in my ears. Hours later, as I ate my dinner of greens and cornbread with molasses, Becky entered the kitchen with a scowl.
That Corzine boy, the one with the hat, he's in front of the house again, she said.
You must tell him to leave. I lifted my eyes from my plate.
Why?
Because Madam wants him arrested, and I don't want trouble, that's why, Becky snapped. I did not move.
Do you want his beating on your conscience?
She continued. I chewed the last of the cornbread, then wiped my fingers and stood up.
Tell him to stay away,
she said as I set my plate in the washing-up tub.
Blasted fool doesn't know what's good for him.
When I lifted the latch of the garden gate, Corzine appeared, mouth a-flapping.
Finally, we've much to talk about.
Go away, I said. He glanced up and down the empty street.
Look, I'm sorry. The colonel, I thought sure he would help.
He stopped and leaned close to my face.
You don't look right. Camp fever?
My tongue felt the ragged edge of a broken tooth. I'm fine. He dropped his eyes to the ground.
Sorry's not enough, but I am sorry about all of it.
I picked at a splinter of wood on the gate. There was something changed about him, but I could not figure it. Many things looked different since they burned me up.
Not your concern, I said. 'Tis so, he said. I've asked about your sister. A sailor I know thinks she was put on a ship to Halifax.
No, they sent her to Nevis. He opened his mouth but could not find any words.
Go away, I said, or they'll arrest you, Madam said. Has she received any letters from Lockton?
The question hit me like a bucket of cold water.
You asking me to spy again?
Listen, he started.
Our freedom.
I did not let him continue.
You are blind. They don't want us free. They just want liberty for themselves. You don't understand.
Oh, no. I understand right good, I countered.
I shouldn't have believed your rebel lies. I should have taken Ruth and run the night we landed. Even if we drowned, we would have been together.
He reached out and grabbed my arm.
Don't say that.
His hand was strong, but so was mine. I grabbed his thumb and twisted it backward.
Turn me loose.
My body and voice shook as if trapped in one of Ruth's fits.
Sorry.
He released me and I released him.
I'm sorry for your sister and your face and your broken head.
He wiggled his thumb.
100 times as sorry as the hills.
I moved to shut the gate in his face. He held it open.
We all have scars, Isabel. I'll never talk to you again.
I threw myself against the gate, shut it, and threw home the latch. Chapter 26, Wednesday, August 21st, through Sunday, August 25th, 1776. We have our coach standing before our door every night, and the horses are harnessed, ready to make our escape if we have time. Poor New York! I long to have the battle over, and yet I dread the consequences. Letter written by Mary, daughter of Patriot Brigadier General John Moran Scott, as her family prepared to flee New York. The storm that hit the city the next night was the worst I had ever seen. A thundercloud, big as a mountain, swept up the river just before sunset.
Lightning danced at his edges like horses at a mad gallop. Then the sky turned ink black and the storm crashed over us. The wind blew signs off buildings, overturned soldiers' tents, and stripped the clean clothes that had been pegged out to dry. Thunder boomed like a thousand cannons. A house three blocks over was struck by a lightning bolt and burned to the ground. 13 soldiers were killed by lightning, too. The coins in their pockets melted and their flesh roasted. One lightning-struck soldier survived but was turned deaf, blind, and unable to speak. We were forced to concern ourselves with more domestic matters. The window frames in the front parlor leaked terrible during the storm. Rain soaked the drapes and rugs and left the wall plaster soft and spongy. Tell the girl to clean up this mess. Becky asked around for days, but there were no spare carpenters to be found, no matter how much coin was offered. The men were all getting ready for war. The British had set up a new camp in Brooklyn on Long Island, and Washington was moving his troops around like pieces on a checkerboard. He sent most of his men across to face the British and others north to defend Fort Washington in Harlem. The front windows continued to leak. Becky began to talk of leaving for her uncle's house in Jersey. I pretended to listen to her. The streets were filled with the hurry-scurry of a moving army splashing through mud puddles. Madam called for tea. I left to fetch fresh water. A few bees flew out of my head as I walked north with my buckets blown out by the strong east wind. The pain helped, too. I had cut the palm of my left hand on a dull blade at breakfast. Becky wrapped it for me, but it stung to carry even an empty bucket. Nassau Street was fair deserted all the way up to the Commons. Most folks had fled, afeard to be caught between two angry armies. That's why I was surprised to see a crowd at the water pump, a dozen or so men and boys, slaves who had been hired by the army to build barricades, and a few women fetching water like me. Beyond the men, I could see the pile of paving stones that had been pulled up for the barricade. It was midday, and the folks were gathered for a cool drink, a bite to eat, and some conversating. The talk stopped as I approached. All eyes went to my face. I had not been to the pump since my branding. I gripped the buckets tight, holding in the pain. Most in the crowd were strangers to me. "Mercy," muttered one woman as she studied my scar. "Pain you much?" asked another, her hair wrapped in a worn yellow cloth. "It tugs some, ma'am," I said. "Not as much as it did." One man spat over his shoulder and said something in a language I did not understand. The other men turned their eyes from me back to Grandfather, the old man who sat by the pump, and went back to their argument. I was grateful to have the attention leave me.
"You're not looking at the facts," a bald man said to Grandfather. "The British Lord Dunmore in Virginia offered freedom, total freedom, to any slave who escapes to his camp."
He shook his fist in the air when he said freedom.
"Thousands have run away and joined up already."
Grandfather simply nodded his head.
"With more behind them, I expect."
A second man, this one with neatly trimmed hair, leaned on his shovel.
"Dunmore freed the Virginia slaves so the crops would go unharvested and ruin the planters. The British care not for us. They care only for victory. Some patriots own slaves, yes, but you must listen to their words. All men created equal. The words come first. They'll pull the deeds and the justice behind them."
"You're a fool," the bald man said.
He motioned to the piles of paving stones and the logs waiting to be dragged into position.
"We should sabotage the barricades. If the British win, we'll all be free."
"Shh," several people scolded.
I blinked. The bees in my head fell silent and hugged their wings tight to their bodies. The British would free us? All of us? The men fell to arguing with each other, the women chiming in occasionally. Finally, the bald man raised his hand.
"One of us here was privy to the rebel plans, worked with one of the bosses there. Tell us, Corzine boy, what do you think of the rebel lies?"
At the sound of his name, Corzine stepped forward from the side of the building where he had been sitting in the shade. He looked even more changed than he had the week before. What was different?
"What say you?"
Grandfather asked.
"I say I'm an American," Corzine said. "An American soldier."
It was his clothes. When I first met him, he was dressed like the house servant of a wealthy man, which he was. Now the tailored waistcoat was gone, and his shirt was dirty with sweat and mud.
It hung over a pair of working man's breeches that were cut off below his knee. He did not have on stockings or shoes. Even his fancy red hat was flecked with mud. The wind caught at my skirts and swirled them around my ankles. Did he say soldier? The first man laughed. You are an American slave! He untied the cloth around his neck and rinsed it in the pump water before adding in a lower voice, as are we all. Corzine shook his head. He was still stubborn as ever, if a bit worn. Not me. Not for long. Master Bellingham promised me freedom for enlisting in his place. And you believe him? The man laughed louder. He's feeding you to the cannon so he can be safe. If you don't die, he'll stick your neck under his boot again. Lower your voices. Grandfather held up a shaky hand and motioned to me. Come, child. Get your water. I walked to him and set my buckets on the ground. The women in the yellow headcloth worked the pump for Grandfather. The British promised freedom to slaves but won't give it to the white rebels, she said as she pushed the handle up and down. The rebels want to take freedom, but they won't share it with us. She set down the first bucket and picked up the second. Both sides say one thing and do the other. The British act on their promises, insisted the bald man. No, the man with the shovel drove it into the ground with frustration. They lie. When the British fled Boston, back in the spring, they took escaping slaves with them. They promised them freedom. He stretched out the word until it sounded ugly. Where are those slaves now? No one answered him. I'll tell you, he continued. Forced into the Louisburg coal mines in Canada, they work and die under the ground. They never see the sun, and they never taste your freedom. We stood in silence as the pump handle creaked. At last, Grandfather chuckled. This is not funny, old man, said the fellow with the shovel. Young people are always funny, he said. Funny and foolish. The woman in the yellow headcloth finished filling the second bucket. What do you mean, Grandfather?
This is not our fight, the old man said. British or American, that is not the choice. You must choose your own side. Find your road through the Valley of Darkness that will lead you to the River Jordan.
We don't have the River Jordan here, Grandfather, the bald man said as he retied the wet cloth around his neck.
We have the East River, with currents fast enough to kill a man, and the North River, 2 miles wide. Both are mighty hard to cross.
Grandfather chuckled again.
You don't understand. Everything that stands between you and freedom is the River Jordan. Come closer, child.
This last he said to me. I stepped in front of him and reached for my buckets, but he took my hands in his. I stopped, unsure what to do next.
Look at me, he said.
I bent down a little, bringing my face level with his. He tilted my chin to the side so he could examine the brand on my cheek. I tried to pull away, but he held fast.
A scar is a sign of strength, he said quietly. The sign of a survivor.
He leaned forward and lightly kissed my cheek, right on my branded mark. His lips felt like a tired butterfly that landed once, then fluttered away. I stepped back and touched the cheek. The men were returning to the barricades. Other servants had formed a line for the pump. Grandfather winked and handed me the buckets.
Look hard for your River Jordan, my child. You'll find it.
Carrying those full buckets back to the Locktons was powerful hard. The cut on my left hand pained me too much to use it, and my right hand was not big enough, my arm not strong enough to carry 2 buckets at once. I journeyed in a crow hop fashion, carrying 1 bucket for 20 strides, setting it down, then returning to fetch the second bucket and carrying it forward to meet his partner. I made slow progress in this manner for 2 blocks when Corzine joined me. He would not look at me, didn't say a word neither. He simply carried the buckets to the Lockton's gate for me, then walked away. Chapter 27. Monday, August 26th through Saturday, September 14th, 1776. Persons exposed to great danger and hazard removed with all expedition out of the said town, New York, whereas a bombardment and attack may be hourly expected. General George Washington,
official handbill issued to New Yorkers in August 1776. The British thrashed the Patriots in a big battle in Brooklyn, thrashed them but good. They killed or captured near 1,000 rebels and sent the rest scurrying away. After the worst of the battle, the skies opened up again and we all waited, us in a house with leaking windows and a damp parlor, the soldiers in open fields and muddy ditches, for the rain to stop. Madam wore a groove in the floor, pacing back and forth, awaiting news of the final British victory, her footsteps tipping and tapping in measure with the ticking of the clock. I poked at the logs in the kitchen hearth, trying to summon back the bees so they would chase out the thoughts invading my brain pan. But the words of the bald man echoed. Would the British truly free me? Should I flee to them? What about Ruth? Would they help me find her? The firewood was wet and green and would not catch. It smoldered and smoked and made a terrible stink. When morning came, a thick fog smothered New York, the kind Mama called a pea souper. When the fog finally lifted, the American army was not to be found. Washington's men had spent the dark night and foggy morning rowing all the troops back to New York Island. Some 9,000 men, folks said. That Washington was a conjure man, for sure. Madam took to her bed when Becky brought back the news. I muttered a quiet blast and continued to eat my dinner, porridge with dried apple. Becky didn't hear me. She was going on and on about the nasty things she'd passed by at the campgrounds. And there was this one lad, ooh, he'd had his hand blown clean off and a grubby bandage wrapped around his wrist. And I looked at that and I said to myself, that arm's coming off next, young man, and maybe your leg for good measure, on account of a noxious pestilence that filled the air, the stench of the place, and the groans and moans. She shivered with gruesome delight. If I had a stronger stomach, I'd take a nurse job and help a bit with the washing of the wounds and the like. But with this heat and the flies, you just know the wounds will be maggoty by morning, and if there's one thing I can't abide, it's the sight of maggots and living flesh. I looked in my bowl. The dried apple bits curled like fresh hatched maggots. I stopped eating. Becky ladled out her own meal. They's all saying that this proves the Lord himself is on the side of the rebellion on account of that fog he created. Did the same thing for them back in Boston, blew in a thick mist so the American army could win the day. It seemed to me that if God really wanted the Americans to win, he would have sent sea monsters to devour the fleet when it left Boston. As I went to empty my porridge into the scraps bucket, Becky pointed to her own bowl. I filled it with my leftovers and commanded my belly to stop flopping so at the sight of the curly apples. Becky paused with her spoon in the air. Makes a body wonder, though. What? I asked. Washington had them melt down the church bells and remake them into cannons. That will surely displease the Lord, I say. If God switches sides and allows the British to take New York, you'll see me headed for Jersey, back pay or no back pay. I'm not sitting here waiting to get carved into pieces by them beastly redcoats. It took me 8 days of slow trips to the market and the water pump before I finally spied Corzin working with other men to set up a filthy tent in the mud of the Battery campgrounds. It was good to see him not dead nor chopped up. Chapter 28, Sunday, September 15th, 1776. The clouds grow very dark. Diary of William Smith, Chief Justice of the Province of New York. The true invasion of New York started with the firing of 100 ship's cannons when we were at church Sunday morning. The first blast made the women shriek. The second blast made me wonder if God himself was fixing to blow the island apart. The third blast caused us to run for the door. Rebel soldiers were dashing every which direction on the street, muskets in their hands, officers bellowing loud. The horses pulling carts and carriages whinnied nervously, bobbing their heads up and down and rolling their eyes in fear of the commotion and noise. The cannons roared again. The sound was coming from the East River side of the island, to the north. I searched the skies for flaming comets, for that was how I pictured a cannonball would look. All I saw was startled birds and campfire smoke. The city itself seemed unharmed, though fear ran neck deep. Madam reached out and grabbed at the coat of an officer striding toward the battery fort. He whirled, a curse on his lips, but caught himself when he realized he was speaking to a lady. "Does this unholy racket mean the arrival of the war?" Madam asked. "Yes, ma'am," the officer said.
But you need not be afraid. The generals have the matter well in hand.
He hesitated as the cannons roared again.
Civilians should go home and lock your doors. Do not peer out of windows.
Madame contemplated him coolly.
What are those men doing?
She asked, pointing to the campground. The soldiers were quickly assembling their guns, ammunition, and whatever they could stuff into